Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
It was hard for us to let her go to California. I mean, of all the places for her to get abducted in her own backyard.
So the prevailing theory based on that was always it had to be somebody who knew her to some degree because they wanted to separate themselves from the crime scene, from everything, because there is no physical evidence.
Hello, and welcome to episode 59 of The Vanished. 19-year-old Rachel Cook was home from college for the winter break in January of 2002. One morning, she headed out for her daily run carrying just her yellow Sony Walkman. She was seen by multiple witnesses that day, but as far as anyone can tell, she never made it home. Was Rachel abducted by a random stranger who just happened to be in her neighborhood that day? Or was she targeted by someone she knew? This is Rachel's story. Rachel was at a very exciting point in her life. She was attending San Diego Mesa College to fulfill her general education requirements and was planning to go on to school for fashion design. She had a boyfriend that everyone just thought was wonderful, and she was enjoying all the fun things that people do at 19. During the winter break, her boyfriend Greg came home with her to visit her family in Georgetown, Texas. Greg left to go back to San Diego while Rachel stayed longer in Georgetown to attend her cousin's wedding. On the morning of Thursday, January 10th, Rachel's father Robert left for work. Soon after, around 8 a.m., her mom Janet and Rachel's younger sister Joanne left as well. Janet was an art teacher at the local high school, and Joanne was still attending high school, so the two left together. This is the last time that they saw Rachel. When they left, she was asleep on the couch. Around 9 a.m., Rachel got a call on her cell phone from her boyfriend. She told Greg that she was going to go for her run and that she would call him when she got back. This call ended around 9:15 a.m., After that call, she got up and got ready to go run. Rachel was an avid runner who was involved in cross country for many years. She was known to run 4 to 6 miles on a daily basis. We know that she did, in fact, go running that morning because while she was out that day, many people saw her. She passed one couple around 10 a.m. and then passed them again about 20 minutes later. A woman and her daughter who were working out in their yard witnessed Rachel run by and she waved to them. Another couple was pulling into their driveway around 10:45 a.m. They saw Rachel and waited for her to pass so they could enter their driveway. At this time, she was walking to cool down at the end of her run. This couple lived very close to the Cooks, and where they saw her was just 200 yards from her home. This is the last known sighting of Rachel. Later that afternoon, Rachel's dad Robert came home from work. He had plans to take Rachel shopping, but when he got home, he noticed that Rachel's phone and purse were there, but she wasn't. This was out of character for Rachel. He called one of her friends to see if she had heard from Rachel, but the friend said although she had plans with Rachel later that day, she hadn't seen or heard from her. Rachel had worked at a restaurant called Wildfire, so Robert called over to the restaurant to see if she possibly picked up a shift. When he called, they told him that yes, Rachel was working. This was a relief. He figured that someone had picked her up to take her to work and she just forgot her phone and purse. When Rachel didn't return later that evening, they again became concerned. In the morning, they called Wildfire again, and unfortunately, the Rachel who had been working the day before was a different Rachel. Now her family was in a panic. They started looking through her belongings and could tell that the only things missing were the clothes that she would run in and her yellow Walkman. This is when they realized that she must have gone out running and never made it back. They went out driving to see if she had been hit by a car. They checked hospitals and went to the police department to report her missing. The police did not initially take her disappearance very seriously. They assumed that she was just off with friends. The family decided to start searching on their own, and many people came out to help. When law enforcement caught wind of this, they came out and shut the search down. They didn't want any evidence to be contaminated. The next day, Texas Rangers got involved and there was a huge search with dogs, ATVs, people on horseback, and even Texas Equisearch became involved. Unfortunately, in the 15 years following her disappearance, no trace of Rachel has ever been found. I spoke with her mom, Janet, and she told me how they initially realized that Rachel was missing.
When I got home later that evening, Robert said, "Rachel's not home." I said, "Oh." He said, "Well, she's probably gone to so-and-so's house or so, you know, her friends." And I had to go work in the evening at a theater, and I came back at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and she still wasn't home. And that's when I was a little concerned, because usually she'd tell us, and then I realized her purse and her cell phone weren't there. And so the next morning, got up, she still wasn't home. And I went into school, but as soon as I walked in the door of my classroom, my kids were in there, and I said, "Something's terribly gone wrong. Rachel's not home. And something's not right. Something's way wrong." Because she wouldn't leave her purse or her cell phone, especially the cell phone. And that's when my students pushed me out of the door and said, "Go, go." And so one student called the principal's office and told him I was leaving. And I took off and got home, and I said, "We need to report this. Rachel's not home." And, you know, her daddy was supposed to take her shopping that day. And so we went immediately. He went and drove her usual route that she took. And I took off to one of the elementary schools to talk to her former boyfriend, who at one point they had been engaged, and she had cut it off, and it was not going. He was not wanting to for the relationship to end. So I went to his mother, who worked at an elementary school, and asked her if she knew where Thomas was. She said, "No, I think he's getting a haircut." And she dialed his cell phone, and he said he was getting a haircut. She asked him, "Do you know where Rachel is?" And he said, "No." So I left there, and about that time I got a call from Robert. He couldn't find her. He said he was at the sheriff's department, and I met him there. And I also went to the hospitals. And I'm sure they thought I was totally weird, because I walked right up to the emergency entrance and said, "Have y'all seen my daughter? Is there a patient come in that's Rachel, that's blonde hair, 5'2"? And they checked their records, and they hadn't had anybody by that description come in. So I met Robert over at the sheriff's office, and this guy came out with a yellow pad and took down our information and said, "Well, she's probably just gone out with friends, and, you know, maybe she went somewhere for a few days or something." And both Robert and I tried to explain to the officer, "No. Rachel would not do that without her cell phone or without her driver's license or purse or whatever." She would, you know, parents do know. Law enforcement needs to listen to parents in missing persons cases, because we know that kid better than probably most. And I told him, I said, "You can call any of her friends. They would agree with us." And he said, okay, well, we'll get on it. So we left there, and we just went home and sat on the couch. We didn't know what to do. And one of the people from school called or something, but next thing I know, we have friends and people that we worked with coming over and wanting to search. So we started searching. It was about 9 o'clock at night. We were walking around in the dark, calling Rachel's name, but nothing. And then 2 days later, after we filed, I think it was two, maybe three, one of my coworkers, her husband was the sheriff. She says, "Well, wait a minute." And so they called him, and he came out. And the next morning, you know, law enforcement showed up. But I don't think that Georgetown had had a missing persons case before like this. It's where somebody just vanished. You know, there was no motive for running off. She was all excited and trying to figure out which wedding dress to wear to the wedding and da 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 da. She would not have taken off. At least not on her own accord.
In a case like Rachel's, you have to wonder if someone had been watching her. Janet told me that she had been home for about a week and a half to 2 weeks. Since she was someone who would go out jogging on a daily basis, This could have been enough time for someone to notice her routine. I asked Janet if Rachel always ran the same route.
Well, sometimes she varied the route just because of weather or whatever and how she felt. But pretty much it stayed about the same for the most part. But I know that a couple days prior, the day prior, she had talked about going down toward the lake. And I had said, well, why didn't you go all the way to the lake? You know, I mean, go for it. And so she may have, you know, tried to go further.
Janet gave me some more information about their neighborhood. I had wondered if the homes were far enough apart that someone could have abducted her without being seen. She told me that some of the homes were on 1 acre, others 3 acres, and some were on as much as 5 to 10 acre lots. Also, a lot of the homes were set further back off the road. So there were spots that she would have run past that were out of view from any of the homes. I suppose the gamble here would be for someone to grab her and get her into a vehicle without anyone driving by. At the time of Rachel's disappearance, there was construction going on at more than one home in the area. There has been speculation that someone at one of those work sites could have abducted Rachel.
The day before, she had talked to him about how they were creeping her out because they'd holler things at her, you know. Construction workers are prone to do that. That's one of the first things I told them to do is to check with the construction people. But a lot of the workers were illegal or undocumented. And so sometimes, I guess, foremen don't keep a list of that. And I'm not sure what kind of records they keep. Probably not real great, because it's cash on the hoof.
Several leads came in about a sports car that was seen driving around the area. Some people reported it as a Trans Am. Other people reported it as a Camaro. Janet told me a bit more about this lead.
One of the people that reported the sports car, that was me. And there were two Hispanic guys in it, and it was right at the end of the street. If you're facing our house, it would have been to the right. They were there for 2 days. The first day, I didn't pay any attention to it. The second day, I was like, well, what's going on? Why are they just sitting in that car? So I reported it. We were all out looking for the Trans Ams. I called in probably 4 or 5 that I saw on the road, you know, out one driving around. And I'm assuming they were checked out. In fact, one of the ones I called in belonged to a law enforcement officer. I don't know what branch or whatever, but one of the vehicles, there was, you know, lots of vehicles being turned in as suspicious, but one of them was just some kids from the neighborhood or from the area that were driving around smoking pot. Yeah, so that one was, they talked to them.
At first glance, Rachel's disappearance looks a lot like it could be a stranger abduction. But some people have questioned whether Rachel's ex-fiancé could be involved. Janet told me about a time that he stopped by their house in the middle of the night before Rachel disappeared.
Yeah, I answered the door. He was inebriated, which he was a lot at that point in time, even more so now. And he wanted to see Rachel. He wanted to, you know, talk. I just want to talk to Rachel. I said, no. You know, 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, no. And so I had to tell him that I was going to call the sheriff's department if he didn't leave. Well, then Rachel comes out of her bedroom, says, no, Mom, I'll talk to him. And I said, no, go back in your room. You don't need to talk to Thomas while he's drunk. So I let her talk for a few minutes, and then I said, okay, it's time to go. And that's how that ended. He wasn't happy.
Janet gave me her take on the possibility of Rachel's ex-fiancé being involved.
I think if he didn't do it, he knows something. And I would love for him to come forward and just, you know, take a load off. Now, law enforcement has spoke with him, I believe, on numerous times. I've wanted to talk to him, just him and me. You know, no law enforcement, no nothing. But I don't want to jeopardize, you know, what's going on. So I haven't done it. But, I mean, there's also other people that I suspect as well. So, I mean, not knowing anything about her abduction, you know, she could be part of a sex ring, of course. I don't know, and I need to know something. all those people that know Rachel need to know. Whether justice is done or not, at least having that one piece will help. It won't give us peace, but it will give us more of an understanding.
There was a big development in Rachel's case in 2006. A convicted murderer by the name of Michael Moore, not to be confused with the documentary filmmaker and author, came forward and admitted to killing Rachel. He said that he came up behind her with a hammer and hit her in the back of the head. He also claimed to have raped her and disposed of her body in the Matagorda Bay. He said that he had been driving a pickup truck that day, and there were reports of a truck in the neighborhood, so this did lend some credibility to his story. Moore agreed to take a guilty plea, but when the day came, he decided to change his plea to not guilty. This was a huge emotional roller coaster for her family. They were led to believe this terrible story was true, and then in court had that ripped out from under them. Janet told me what it was like in court that day.
Yeah, I had to grip onto the seat, because when he said not guilty, sitting there and staring toward me and looking at his black eyes that were just empty, I just almost came unglued from that seat. I was so pissed. I wanted to get up and hit him, but I would have ended up in a pile on the floor. So
Moore has since stated that he only admitted to killing Rachel to get special treatment, but the question still lingers as to whether or not he could be responsible for her disappearance.
I'm not totally sure. I think only he really knows, and I'm not sure at this point whether he even knows. From what I've heard and what I saw in the courtroom, he doesn't have a conscience. I don't know if he did it. I don't really think he did, but he may have known somebody who was involved, or he may have known somebody who knew somebody. He wanted a change of venue. He wanted to get out and get some, you know, good meals and some notoriety. Just get out of the doldrums of being in jail. I'm sure it's probably very boring there.
To further complicate things, this confession could be brought up in the future if someone else is tried in connection to her disappearance. The possibility that Moore is responsible could be enough to create reasonable doubt in the minds of a jury. Nathan spoke to Wade Knutson, who has been the detective on Rachel's case for many years. Wade was able to give us some great insight into multiple aspects of Rachel's case, including some of the initial missteps and the current status of the case.
Inheriting the case after it's passed through the hands of a number of other detectives, are there any challenges in addition to the usual challenges in a missing persons case that you got to grapple with?
Yeah, the biggest challenge is on like a case that long. So I got it in 2013. Of course, it happened in 2002, so that's 11 years. And when we get it, you know, the hardest part is there's so many reports. I think there were 680-something reports. And then there was the guy that had it for the few years before me. He had just written one, you know, continuously long narrative. And so that was, you know, probably another 300 pages there.
Wow.
And so they always want to just kind of walk in and tell you about the case. And the hardest thing is to tell somebody, no, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to read it. I don't want, you know, your version. I want to read it. And when I have questions, I'll come back to you. So that's always kind of the hardest part to do, because it'd be so much easier to say, yeah, tell me about it. So we sat down, and I want to say the first probably 3 months, all we did was go through it. And the hardest part about it is because it happened in 2002, everything was printed out. So there were notebooks of reports. And so we went through them all, pulled them all out, separated them out individually, and we digitized everything. So we did it by date of report and author and what it was about to kind of reorganize the entire case file. And so now when we get a tip that comes in, instead of going, you know what, that sounds familiar, let me sit down and read for half an hour and try to figure out where I saw that, we've actually got a searchable document, so that made it a little bit easier. We could go back through there and look for that specific keyword or time frame or name or whatever we needed. And so that made it a little bit easier to go through, but it was just so many volumes of material to have to sift through.
So were you dedicated full time to this?
Yes, that was myself and another guy, and for the first 7 months, all we did was sit there and go through this and figure out where we stood, what direction needed to be taken, and do the follow-up that we could do, and then try to find any new material, which we were able to find some new material that was previously unknown in the case file, and then try to develop the leads out of that.
So after going through all of that, what jumped out at you?
The biggest problem in the case is the lack of physical evidence. And so basically on Thursday morning, January 10th, 2002, Mom, Janet, went to work to go to school, took a little sister with her. Dad went to go work at IBM, and Rachel was at home without a car. She woke up at about 9 o'clock when she got a call from her boyfriend who had already gone back to California, which is where she was going to college. So once she graduated high school in Georgetown, she came back for Christmas that year, went back to California, came back around May for her birthday, and then went back to California and was back again for Christmas. And so, you know, obviously she didn't live here full time anymore, but she still worked at the Wildfire restaurant here in Georgetown. So she got up about 9:30. About 10 o'clock, she goes for a run. And so she's last seen around 11, 11:30, getting done with her run within about 1,000 feet of her house, about 300 yards, by a neighbor who's watching her walk, waiting for her to walk past the driveway so they could pull into their own driveway and park. And she spotted probably a dozen and a half times by various people during that jog. And so there's nothing, nobody seems to be following her, nothing strange like that, and then she's just gone. And so, you know, we took that and said, let's kind of look at this and go from there. Well, the biggest problem that we had was Robert, the father, got home first. So when he arrived home that afternoon, I want to say around 2 or 3, she's not there. She had plans to go do something, thought, well, maybe she went with a friend to go do something. So he didn't make a big deal out of it. And then Janet and the sister get home, and she's still not there. So they're starting to get a little bit worried. They call the friend. The friend says, you know what? She never showed up. We were supposed to go to movies. She never showed up. She never called. So they call over to the Wildfire restaurant, thinking maybe she picked up another shift. And they said, is Rachel there? Yes, Rachel's here. Okay, well, that's it. Mystery solved. Rachel's at work. She picked up another shift. Well, then her phone rings in her purse, which they thought was strange because she wouldn't have gone anywhere without her phone. And then they start getting worried. And then it rolls around midnight. She's still not home. They've gone out. They've driven the streets around the neighborhood knowing that she went for a jog, looking for her, making sure she wasn't hit by a car in the ditch or anything like that. So they didn't call the police because they were under the mistaken belief that you had to wait 24 hours to report a missing person. And so the next morning, they didn't sleep all night, got up. Robert came to the sheriff's office. Janet went to the local hospitals. And when Robert came to the sheriff's office to make the report, they said, okay, we'll put somebody on it right away. That was Friday. Well, apparently to that person, right away meant we'll look at it Monday. So obviously that wasn't good enough for Robert. And he was a very soft-spoken man. And so he didn't say anything. He just went out and he got his family and he got volunteers together and they started searching Friday. They were supposed to be at a wedding that weekend. I think they canceled the wedding. So they searched Saturday. And on Sunday, they had several hundred people out there, is my understanding, on horseback, on four-wheelers, getting ready to search the entire area. Well, the current sheriff was a guy named John Maspero, and his wife was a teacher. And so what they said was, one of the other teachers who worked with Janet at the school came up and says, have you talked to the sheriff? I know his wife. I teach with her. And they said, yeah, they said it would be Monday. And she goes, no, that doesn't sound right. Let me go make a phone call. That woman went and called John Maspero's wife, who got Maspero up, and they sent people out there right away. At that point, when the detectives showed up, they tried to round everybody back up. But you're 3 days out from the event of her missing at this point, and you've got what, you know, could be considered by a lot a very contaminated crime scene. You got a bunch of people everywhere walking all over the place with horses and four-wheelers and everything else. So that's the hardest part, is just the lack of evidence, because there wasn't an immediate response to the scene.
She wasn't at work that day when they called.
No, it was a different Rachel.
Okay.
And, you know, they didn't ask the last name, and so that was a point of confusion for everybody, and they figured that out later.
Okay. So looking at satellite images of that area, there's quite a bit of distance between the houses, and given the number of people who had seen her jogging, I mean, people seemed pretty attuned to what was happening, and I understand there was some construction going on at some of the residences across the street, and then next to the Cook's residence.
right down the street, there was a utility crew that was boring underneath the street for a water line. There was a house under construction. Actually, the guy that lived directly across the street from the Cooks was a Travis County deputy. And his car, he was off that day. His car was parked in his driveway. So there was a lot of construction. We went through, and in the original case file, they went through all the subcontractors that had been in the neighborhood and looked at all that, who was working, what companies were there, what were the names, you know, associated with them, and did their due diligence in looking at all those folks. You know, and when you look at something like this, one of the first things you look at is, you know, is this a crime of opportunity? Normally, if it's a crime of opportunity with someone who's not very associated with it, it's haphazard. They leave physical evidence. You know, time and distance is a criminal's friend. So the further that they can get away from the crime scene, the further they can get away from the disposal of, you know, even say disposal of a body, the better off for them. Well, if you've got no attachment to it, you've got no association with the crime, other than the fact I just saw this person and I grabbed them, you're not going to have to work as hard to distance yourself, whereas somebody who would have to work very hard, you would have to distance yourself further. So the prevailing theory based on that was always, it had to be somebody who knew her to some degree because they wanted to separate themselves from the crime scene, from everything, because there is no physical evidence.
So are there viable suspects at this point?
Well, it's still an open active investigation, so I can't talk about that. But yes, there are suspects in the case file.
Hmm. And so you're not going to be on the case here real soon. Is that correct? That's what I've heard.
Correct.
So how does that work in Texas? You guys get a new sheriff, and then he can restaff the office, or
he can do whatever he wants. Yes.
Is this case solvable, do you think?
Yes, I think it is. I think it's going to take a couple of things. And the guy, the detective and I that had it last, he got taken off of it, and it was just me for about the last year and a half. It's going to take that finding of one key piece of evidence. You know, we know there are places that she never was. So if we can find the evidence that would put her in one of those places, there are places that people claim she never was. So if we can find the evidence that puts her there, a hair, a fingernail, something like that, then that would throw certain people's stories completely off balance enough that it would implicate them. It would take the finding of some key pieces of evidence like the Walkman. She was wearing a yellow Discman, actually, not a Walkman, you know, the kind with headphones and it plays the CDs. This was before MP3s and all that stuff. So finding something like that, some key piece of evidence that would tie into that where it would lead us back to the persons of interest that we've already got developed, that would certainly be something that would cause it to be solved. We know that there are problems with certain individuals and their stories and what their version of events are. So it's just a matter of, you look at it 12 years later and you're like, why didn't they do this back then? And I don't know, can't answer that. Why they did, why they didn't. A lot of it is they were given some marching orders, and they went and did what they thought they were supposed to be doing, and it sounds like maybe they kind of missed some key investigative steps.
So with Michael Moore,
yeah.
When somebody offers a false confession to a crime like this, and there's resources devoted to, you know, verifying his story, did that hurt the case at all from what you were able to review?
Yeah, I think that in the long run, you know, things like that are going to make it more argumentative if it ever goes to court, because of the fact they're going to say, well, didn't this person confess, or didn't this person say that? Didn't, you know, wasn't this person considered to be taken to the grand jury for indictment? And those are all things that you have to contend with when you get to that point. With Michael Moore, I really think that was a situation where that guy, he's a bad guy, evil guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the end of the day, people looked at him and thought, you know, this is somebody who could have done this. And I think he was so enamored with the idea that he could get law enforcement in Williamson County, you know, to bite on something one more time just to embarrass them, that he thought that it was worth it. And he even made an apology later on to the family through the media. And so that was the one thing about that. When he did that, it bothered him, you know, when he had to look at the family over there, and they thought they were going to get resolution to the case, and he was like, well, maybe that wasn't the best idea. But he was doing it for his own selfish purposes. And I think a lot of that, with the investigator that got that confession, I think he kind of got a little too close to it and gave up a little bit too much information. You're dealing with a seasoned convict who's able to pull those details from you and then regurgitate back to you, like close enough to being their own that it sounds reasonable, sounds real. And I think that's what happened with Michael Moore. And then, you know, if you want to believe it bad enough, sometimes it's pretty easy. And I think the story that he did with Austin American Statesman a couple of years later, where he talked about, you know, I was fully clothed with boots and blue jeans and a long denim shirt, but I was out for a jog. How does that work? And then I hit her with a hammer. Well, what was I doing, jogging with a hammer in my hand or had it with a bat? And then on top of that, when you look at the timeline that was developed, which where we know she was last seen, it's not possible that he did what he claimed he did, where he claimed he did it, knowing where she was last seen within 1,000 feet of the house. And so those things should have been looked at. I think that because there was a confession, just like in far too many times, somebody jumped without going, hold on, let's sit down and just analyze this with raw data for a second. And I think that was part of the problem there.
So are you able to speak to what a motive may have been for why somebody may have wanted to hurt her?
We don't really want to get into that with an open active case, just because it's still open and active. We do have, like I said, during our time looking at it, develop suspects, persons of interest, and we have an idea of what their motivation would have been. So it's a matter of finding the key evidence, and that's the part that we're missing.
Okay. And then being pulled off a case like this, does it stick with you?
Well, you know, it's not real often that you get to sit down and dedicate 7 months to just reading one report, to just reading one case. So that in itself is something that's unusual. And when you get to do it, yeah, it sticks with you because you know the details in and out. You're fielding the, I think last year, 2016, we took in 16 distinctly different tips regarding the case.
Really?
So going through that, you know, you go through and you reread the report every time one comes up, every time a name comes up, a familiar name. So it does stick with you to that degree because you do know it so well. And also, I think, just the Cook family story, you know, Georgetown's not a big community. It's growing. It's one of the fastest growing in the U.S. But back then, it wasn't a very big town. And so it's a family that so many other people can put their shoes in. I've got 2 daughters, roughly the same age between Rachel and Joanne. And so, you know, I can see that situation. And they're grown up. You got one of them out of school, and then they like to jog. They're active. And then she just almost plucked from the earth. And what happened? It's a mystery that it just needs to be solved. And I think because of that, so many people are able to look at it and say, well, I can see an attachment to this case on some degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems weird that with all the activity in the neighborhood, no one saw anything, huh?
And that's whenever we got to looking at who we developed as a suspect, that's one of the things that we noted as well. That was something that stuck out to us.
I think that probably covers it, unless there's anything else you think is important to touch on or noteworthy.
No, I mean, I know that we planned the run, the Rachel Cook run, so I'm a runner. I run with a local group of folks here in town called We Run Georgetown. I'm part of the Georgetown Running Club. And when I go run, I run half marathons and obstacle course races. I got a wall, a board on my wall where I hang all my medals when I get done. And so Janet comes by about once every month, every 2 months, and she'd sit down in the office and we'd just chat, see how she's doing, you know, talk about anything going on with the case. And she'd always talk about Rachel being a runner and talk about the medals. And man, I'd really like to have this Rachel Cook Memorial Run get going again. We did it the first couple of 3 years when Rachel came up missing, but then Robert got sick and we couldn't do it anymore. And then after Robert passed away, they lost their 503c status. So that, you know, was a hindrance to be able to raise money to do the race, to put the race on. And I kind of tried to push it off to some other people who knew what they were doing with organizing races, and I couldn't get anybody to bite. I guess it was probably in about August or so she came by and said, you know, it's going to be the 15th anniversary. I'd really like to have that run. At that point, I said, let me talk to some folks, the group I run with. If I can get them to help me and be involved, then I think we can get it done. Yeah, that's the least that we can do. And so it's just people from the community who have gotten together to show their support for her. And we couldn't have done it without the local businesses giving us money to buy the shirts, to buy the permit for the race, things of that nature. And we all kind of did it in our own time. We didn't, you know, we're not paid. I wasn't paid by the sheriff's office to go play on the race. And, you know, I told Janet, I said, I wish I could call you up and tell you as the investigator what happened to your daughter. I'm just not able to do that. I told her my theory on what I think happened. But can't prove that at this point. And I said, this as a human being is probably the least I can do for you. You want to have a race that will be in remembrance of your daughter. You like to run. We're going to put on a race. And so, yeah, that's the big thing is we're just trying to make a good event to show the community support for the Rachel Cook situation, for the Cook family, as just a bunch of runners.
Yeah, it seems like the community is really, really rallied behind the family. It's been really
they always have.
Oh, I do have one last question. I heard somewhere along the line about a car and evidence from the car being sent in at some point. Is that familiar and something you can comment on?
Yeah, I can. So last year I was interviewed by the Austin American Statesman, and she asked the question, is there any material that's still being tested? And so over the course of the time, you know, 12 years into the case, whenever I got assigned to it, you start looking at the things that were collected. Some of it's at the DPS state lab down in Austin. Some of it's sitting in our evidence unit, locked up in evidence or in cold storage. So you start going through that stuff and you start figuring out what is important, what needs to be tested. And then as we were following up on the leads that we had developed by going through the case file and discovering new evidence, we collected new stuff. And so there was a vehicle that was related, and we did locate that vehicle after 12 and a half years of them searching for it, the original investigator searching for it, and we were able to process it. But unfortunately, with any vehicle, 12 and a half years later, there's a bunch of other stuff in there.
Yeah.
So we went, we collected everything that we could collect out of the vehicle and sent it off for testing. And unfortunately, at this point, science isn't at the point where what we've collected was fruitful. And so we've retained it, and we're going to, you know, continue to retain it until we can get some to a point where we can possibly have it tested again and get that missing clue piece of evidence that could prove up what we believe happened.
Yeah, you never know where the science will go, do you?
Well, you never do. And, you know, that's the one thing I always tell people is, you know, when you try a case and I hear about all this new science, this new DNA, that, you know, they didn't have that. You can't really plan the case around evidence X whenever you're getting ready to prosecute it, but whenever you're getting ready to try to investigate it, that might come in handy later. So you always want to hang on to it because you don't know what science X that's going to come out next is going to be.
I know. When I always watch these cold cases where, you know, somebody committed a crime in 85 and they get caught, you know, late 90s when the DNA testing comes available, I just think of all the people out there who've done bad things or are sweating.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly right. Exactly right.
So, great. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to chat with us, and good luck with the run.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence.
They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished.
So you heard Wade mention the Rachel Cook Memorial Run. That is being held this weekend, and I will be posting a link in the show notes and also on social media for anyone in the Georgetown area who may be interested in attending. There's also going to be another event held on January 14th. That will be a free self-defense course, and I will post a link for that too. Rachel's mom, Janet, will also be there. In missing persons cases like Rachel's, which is now going on 15 years, you can often see the toll that it takes on families who are victims themselves. Rachel's father, Robert, became involved in various missing persons organizations. Sadly, Robert passed away in 2014 without ever finding out what happened to Rachel.
One of the last things that I said to him right before he passed was the fact that, you know, you're going to know. You're going to get an answer. I'm not. But I'm sure he knows now. He's probably at peace more so than the rest of us, knowing what happened.
Janet told me about the toll the last 15 years has taken on her and also on her relationships with others.
There's a whole lot of people that want me to put this thing to bed, to just, you know, quit with the stuff I'm doing. And it's hard on me. I'm not going to lie about that. You know, it's an emotional burden that I'm bearing. But I can't. And I can't make them understand that what happened, you know, people will tell you, I'm not the same person I was. But you can't go through something like this and just go back to what used to be normal and act like nothing's happened. It affects every point of your being. And so if they know someone has gone through this, you know, don't try to make it better for them because it's not going to work, you know. Just be there for them. I couldn't tell you how many people that I don't see anymore because it hurts them too bad to be with me because it's, you know, it's Rachel smacking their face. But you know what? I could use those hugs, you know, and if it would make them feel better to hug, you know? I mean, I could have used them just like, how you doing? Rather than just totally alienate themselves from me, you know? It hurts because there's a lot of good people out there that I used to hang with that aren't comfortable being around me anymore. And I'm sure that's the case for most parents of missing. And I have to understand, and I try real hard, not to shove it in people's face constantly, you know, and that there's still a me. And Rachel's not all that I am. But, you know, 15 years, I have to publicly say, hey, guys, my daughter's not here still. I have to do things like this, not just for Rachel, but for all those people out there missing someone. Years ago, you didn't hear about missing persons cases. They kind of swept it under the rug because it was such a horrifying thing. Nobody wanted to report on it or whatever. They might do a report at the initial onset, but then follow-up wasn't done. And I understand that, but this needs to be, and it's becoming, it is a national problem. And as such, law enforcement and the general public need to recognize that, you know, and do all they can to help ensure that those persons of our future aren't taken away from us. I've been known to call parents when the child is found and call them and tell them, I'm so happy for you, you know, and when a child is taken, I've called them and said, just hang in there. Don't let up, you know, don't let go.
With Rachel's case, so many different theories have been thrown around. Was it someone she knew? Was it her ex-fiancé? Was it a complete stranger? One thing that I've thought about quite a bit is where Rachel was taken from. We know that those neighbors saw her very close to her home. Did someone abduct her right out on the street just before she reached her house? Or could someone have been waiting back at the house for her? There was no sign of a struggle inside the house, but could she have been approached outside? I went and stood outside of my house, and I thought to myself, if someone were to attack me at the street, the chances of someone seeing something would be higher than, say, up by my front door. If someone was watching Rachel and saw her leave, they could have gone and waited for her back at the house. What if it was her ex-fiancé? Remember, he did come to their house late one night. And Janet was not going to put up with him knocking on their door drunk in the middle of the night. Maybe he came back during the day to try to speak with Rachel when he knew her parents would be at work. Her disappearance is such a mystery due to the lack of evidence. It's amazing that so many people saw her that day and someone managed to take her without being noticed. Now, we did speak with one other person for this episode. Nathan spoke with Nancy Rudill from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Rachel was just recently added to their database, even though she was over the age of 18 when she disappeared. There is a law that a lot of people just don't know about. Even a lot of people in law enforcement aren't aware of it. It's called Suzanne's Law, and it's named after Suzanne Lyle, who went missing from the State University of New York at Albany in 1998. This gives law enforcement access to the services that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children offer, like age enhancement technology. I'm going to play that interview for you at the very end of the show because Nancy gave us a ton of educational information, not just related to Rachel's case, but other topics like trafficking and prevention. There's a $50,000 reward that's being offered for information in Rachel's case. If you have any information about Rachel's disappearance, please call Williamson County Crime Stoppers at 1-800-253-7867. That brings us to the end of episode 59. If you would like to contact me, I am on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Please remember to go check out the links that I'm going to share for the upcoming events that are being held for the 15-year anniversary of Rachel's disappearance. And remember, everyone, be alert and aware of your surroundings. This message is very important to Janet. She even told me that she will go up and tap on someone's shoulder if she sees them running with headphones on. I will catch up with you all next week. We will be covering the disappearance of a man from Washington.
At the time that Rachel went missing, she was actually 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And according to the law, we only covered kids up until 18. But thanks to Suzanne's law, we were able to activate and start a new case with NCMEC.
So how has that changed things for you?
At this point, it hasn't changed anything. Honestly, it's just the way that if a tip were to come in into our database, since we are the clearinghouse for all information across the nation, then it would we would be able to assign it to the case. So if somebody were to call in and say that they had a tip regarding the Rachel Cook case, then we would at least now have a case in our file that it would be assigned to.
Gotcha.
My office focuses on prevention education. Mm-hmm. So it's really about providing information to the community to prevent a situation like this happening again. The other thing that's important about this case is that this is an opportunity for us to let law enforcement know that Suzanne's law went into effect in 03. So cases that go up to age 20 can now be reported to us.
Can you tell us, give us a little bit of background on how that came to be?
It's a federal law, okay. And it was actually signed in 2003 by President George W. Bush. And so the most interesting thing about this case is that until 2003, children ages 19 and 20 were not reported to us. So now we do allow that to happen because of Suzanne's law. So that way children that are in college or still at a critical age where we can provide assistance to a law enforcement, we're able to. But the majority of the cases that NCMEC handles are up to 18.
When you talk prevention, one of the weird things with people who go missing is, you know, you don't really anticipate going missing. You don't really anticipate encountering anyone who's going to abduct you. So how do you prevent?
Right. So, of course, in a situation like this, it's more, she was on a run, so that was a little bit different. But in general, we focus on prevention education from the perspective of, for the little ones, about personal safety, about taking a friend, about telling a trusted adult if something, if you encounter something that might be suspicious or make you feel sad, scared, or confused. And then for the older kids, often what we find is technology plays a role when people go missing. So we focus on a program called NetSmarts, which is focused on online safety. And it really goes into what you're putting online. Could it make you more vulnerable or susceptible to somebody targeting you? It goes into not providing about information, passwords, your personal information, your location, but then also really focusing on not meeting up with people that you don't know, talking about how the information that you can put online can make you vulnerable in, you don't always know the person that you're talking to online if they're actually the person that they say they are. Mm-hmm. So that's where when you talk about abduction, the majority of our cases that NCMEC handles are runaway cases. So it's not necessarily the stranger abducting. The percentage cases that we actually handled that are like that are a very small percentage of the overall cases. Whereas in 2015, we had 460,000 reports of missing children. Over 80% were runaway cases. So that kind of gives you an idea of where prevention comes into play, because we're talking about educating kids in not being lured into realizing that, or first-line responders realizing that perhaps if they come across a runaway, that maybe it's not the situation that you think of where it's just, you know, a spoiled kid running away. Perhaps there's a reason why this child's running away. Are they running away from something? Are they running to something? So looking at the situation a little bit differently than maybe we would have 10, 20 years ago.
So the stranger abductions are really, really pretty rare then.
Yes, and I don't want to say they don't happen, because obviously there are parents that are missing their children from stranger abductions, and those are a little bit more critical because it's harder to identify who that person is. Whereas if it's somebody that they know, you can perhaps check on social media or emails or start thinking of the people that you know that the child might have run to. So that's where it's a little bit different when you don't know who the person is at all. Majority of cases are your child's most likely going to be victimized by somebody that you have introduced them to or that they know already in their life. So that's why it's a little bit more critical.
Are missing reports of missing that you're alerted about, is that pretty consistent from year to year in terms of volume?
It's been pretty consistent from what I can see on the numbers. The numbers that have risen, though, are the ones of potential human trafficking victims. Mm-hmm. So out of the 1 in 5 runaways is a potential human trafficking victim, whereas the year before, it was 1 in 6, 1 in 7, 1 in 8. But that also goes to show you that we're educating our community and frontline responders to maybe better identify why is this person running away.
Mm-hmm. And so when it comes to sex trafficking, you know, the issue's been in the news quite a bit over the last decade, and, you know, it seems to come up as a potential theory more often, especially when attractive young women go missing. What does that look like? What an ordinary citizen would look for in terms of trying to identify a sex trafficking ring, or how they get lured into it?
Well, like I said, some of the things are online, being lured online, children that might be more vulnerable. Out of the 1 in 5 potential human trafficking victims that I mentioned, 74% come from the foster care system.
Oh, wow.
So that right there gives you a better idea of where are these kids coming from. So like I said, focusing on the more vulnerable children that perhaps don't have parental supervision quite as much or don't come from a home. I mean, they're under state care when they run.
Wow, that's a big number.
It is a big number.
So then how do they get them to, you know, it seems like, you know, on the one hand, you think like, oh, well, you know, why don't they just run away? Why don't they, you know, what keeps them?
Often, like I said, these kids are more vulnerable. They are looking for love, for security, and these might be things that the person is providing for them. They could be threatened. I mean, there are many reasons why somebody, of course, they're more vulnerable. Like I said, trying to find love is a very hard thing. That's not, it could be food, shelter. So those are just some of the more basic things.
I guess one last quick question for you. Rachel has this annual memorial run. What do events like those, what role do they play in helping stir up information or?
Well, it's always a great, and an event is always an opportunity for us to provide awareness. So we will have a table set up both at the event and also at the brewery for the after party and for packet pickup. All of the runners will be provided information. Again, it's more of a way for us to let people know that we have an office here in Texas. And then also all of the runners will be wearing a missing child picture on their backs. So that's just another way of letting people know that this is a big deal. There are a lot of children that go missing. There are a lot of cases and reasons why they go missing. So it's just an opportunity to start the conversation, to talk about it, to let people know that we have an office also, like I said, in Austin and in Dallas.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.